I got good news.
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
We're blowing stories today. It's the Week in Review. Joni Balter is news analyst for KUOW, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Knut Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com, writer and blogger at Seattle Magazine. Good to see you.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's start in terms of, we'll leave more of the blowing for later when we get to the wind power off the coast. But I want to start with a couple of stories that emerged yesterday out of the Seattle Police Department. Chief Bailey has decided to take a look or even overturn some findings of disciplinary action against officers that went through the process, the Office of Police Accountability and the like. What do you make of this?
Well, I think some of it is kind of concerning, and it begs a ton of questions here. One of the questions that I had was the overturning of discipline, not just in the one case, but in these many cases, some kind of a backroom arrangement between the unions and the interim chief? And I would like to know who else knew about it. Did the mayor know about it beforehand? Was he informed because he's given so much sort of leeway to Interim Chief Bailey? When did this arrangement happen? Those are some of the questions I have. I think, you know, the way the stories were written sort of focused on the one case that involved the reporter from The Stranger. But I think we have to step back and look at the bigger picture here. How many, you know, these are cases that have been through very many steps of the process. And to overturn them, to sort of clear the decks for the new chief coming in, what is this about?
Now, in the Steve Miletich article in the Seattle Times, Steve Miletich has been on this story and has been really covering it. And the Times has been right on it. Bailey said, basically, is this – so if the question is if this is a payback, no, it isn't, he said, adding, that is not a road I would travel. I don't know where that came from.
you have exclamation points no matter what you say has an exclamation.
So he's saying no payback here. But you know, we have heard from a lot of people who are involved in this, and we want to cover it over the next week too, who are saying we're worried about the process right at a time when the monitor is supposed to be helping lead a change to Seattle Police. So
How is this reforming if you're coming in and saying we will remove the sort of discipline side of this? You know, what goes in the file, it just then removes that finding of a sustained complaint. I don't see how that fits with reform.
Well, yeah, and this is the part of the process that is supposed to be building public confidence. In other words, the whole Office of Police Accountability, the whole process for bringing these complaints, following through on them, doing it according to the book, coming to a decision. This is what is supposed to be giving people confidence in the police department. And to do a kind of a wholesale reconsideration of these decided cases. And with this example of a police officer, and nobody seems to dispute the fact that he was unprofessional and intimidating a reporter on public property and threatening to come to his workplace. Completely inappropriate. People agree that that's inappropriate, but then he gets a slap on the wrist and then he doesn't, and then the slap is taken away. there's no sting whatsoever, no mark on his record, et cetera. Suggests someone there just doesn't get it. And you can say, well, is that the sort of the old police culture reasserting itself in this interim period? The argument is, oh, well, we're just trying to clear the decks for the new guy. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say, so you're going to weigh in, but I just wanted, this is all about how Ed Murray is also going to be relating to the this new police. Here's what he was saying during his State of the City address earlier this week.
Our goal is reforming our police department. Our goal is not simply to comply with the requirements of the consent decree. The goal is to weave the recommendations into the fabric of our police force. But it's to do more, to come out on the other side of this as a model for urban policing.
So is that happening when you see these sort of disciplinary actions overturned?
Not in this case. And just to give people a little more information here, in case they haven't been following this, the case in question right now involves Dominic Holden, who's a news editor at The Stranger, and this altercation that Knut described. That altercation is the wrong word. This kind of standoff.
Confrontation, certainly.
Yeah, unnecessary standoff that was created by officers when Dominic was just riding his bike through the city and saw them arresting someone and stopped to just observe from a sidewalk and was told he couldn't be on a public sidewalk when, in fact, he had every right to be. And then,
well, they recognized him.
Well, I don't know if they recognized him or not. He identified himself as a reporter partway through. I don't think they did recognize him, actually. But the issue here is that I see, you know, Dominic is someone who fortunately has a mouthpiece in the city. He can describe this incident. He can bring it to people's attention. He can describe how he's dissatisfied with the process. And when he does that, a lot of people hear it. Think of how many other people have experiences like this and don't have that sort of platform to speak from. And for someone who does have that platform to be treated this way suggests that the people who don't have a platform are going to be treated even worse. So what's happened is the chief has reversed the discipline for the Seattle officer who was involved in the confrontation with Dominic, which a review board said was inappropriate. And
which is the crux of the complaint that's being made. It's not that it was Dominic. I mean, all those other things fair, but a review board looked at it.
Right, right.
The process had been working.
The stranger and our reporter friends saying this was off. The police review board said this was wrong. And Chief Bailey then, you know, like you said, turned a slap on the wrist into a pat on the back, kind of. And so this is concerning. And the question of payback is, for me, whether the Bailey's latitude to do this is Murray offering payback for the guild, which Bailey is obviously a product of, endorsing him. That's where I see the payback concern here. And Murray, by the way, has come out, you know, since all this erupted and said, I support Bailey 100%. Well, that's very alarming also. And Bailey is supposed to be an interim chief. I would hope that this incident confirms that fact and really highlights for Murray that he needs to bring in someone who is from outside the police union and not connected to a history of posturing that will suggest that anytime something like this comes up, it's payback or, you know, protecting one's own inside the police department.
So I almost fell for the argument that, you know, it's better to send this particular officer and some of the others to training than to, you know, keep this discipline mention of sustained in the files. But you could have it still be sustained and still send them to training. There is nothing to prevent that. And the other point is that these cases have all gone through multi-layers of process. So just to come along and say, you know, we got to get ready for this new chief, so let's clean this up here, is a little too facile, I think. I had another question about the mayor here. Is the honeymoon over? And the reason I ask that is because if you think about it, so there's this issue. This is a bona fide problem, shall we say, for the mayor right now. And folks seem to just be quiet about some of the other things that have happened, the replacing of the film office person, James Keblis, who did a fantastic job. Everybody agrees with that. The mayor came in and said he wanted to hire someone else.
I believe on your civic cocktail, you asked him. They asked both Keblis and the other person if they were going to have jobs, and they said, "Well, it's
well, one had been retained and one had been on the maybe list.
The maybe
and
list.
That was Keblis." And, you know, so okay, you're allowed to bring in your own people. We get that. People like, quote, their own team. But there was absolutely no reason to not have Keblis stay there, except for maybe he gave a donation to Mike McGinn. So I'm thinking, Chris Christie, what are you thinking?
I'm not going. I don't know. Is traffic jammed up in over the Montlake Bridge?
Only in the film office, apparently.
I think there are a couple of interesting political questions. One is Ed Murray has said from the very beginning, during the campaign and since, that his number one priority was reforming the police department, getting a new chief. And now part of his process was the decision to to get rid of the interim chief and put a new guy in. Mm-hmm. And the new guy, who is kind of a placeholder, he's not a candidate for the final job, appears to some people to be making decisions that run counter to the spirit of reform. So is the guy that Murray put in there as a placeholder, is he doing sort of dirty work that needs to be done that they don't want the new guy to have to deal with? Or is he actually making it more difficult to recruit somebody in because people are going to be put in place in the command structure and in the shuffling around that will make the new chief's job tougher? Mm-hmm. So the transition between this temporary situation and actually getting a new chief, this temporary situation could affect the candidates or how the department is perceived as going forward. And that's kind of a critical step for this whole thing to be successful. The second political question is, what's the city council going to do? Most of the city council backed Murray. Most of the city council is very supportive. Are they going to question these decisions in any kind of public way? I'm thinking Tim Burgess. I'm thinking of Bruce Harrell. I'm thinking of the supporters on the council. Or are they going to stay in lockstep behind the mayor because they don't want to break ranks at this point? So I would like to see what their response is. And I think the red flag here is the fact that they want to review all these other cases. The only reason you want to review them is because you're not going to make the punishments harsher. That's right. Not why you're reopening them.
Right. And we're talking about 25 other cases here, right, in addition to the one that the Stranger newsletter was.
So anyway, I think there's some questions here about, what are the people who backed Murray on the council? How are they going to respond in detail? I think they will. Some of them want to see more detail on what's going on over there.
And that's a very good point about what the council will do, because five of them endorsed Ed Murray, so they're sort of on the team for the moment. But I also think we need to mention Jim Pugel here, the interim chief for a while, until he was told, you better go off to the side here if you want to be a candidate for the full-time job. They're very unlikely to pick Jim Pugel because he's of the old department. But don't forget that he was the Department of Justice thought of him as a reformer. They mentioned that he had done a good job on that.
And he is a reformer. That's been his record. And in fact, that's what he did before he was demoted and pushed to the sidelines, partly so that he can be in the running. And he kind of kicked some people off the command staff that then Bailey brought back in once Pugel was out. And I think that...
Does that send a message too? One of those people was Nick Metz, right? He was out.
The message it sent to a lot of people, and it was sort of in the category of concern and rumor that wasn't verified, and now with this incident this week seems to be becoming confirmed. The message that it sent was, we are going the other way now. Bailey is going to be using the administrative tools that he has available to undo whatever reform Pugel was trying to do, and to use this period before the new chief comes in to, as I think Joni was saying, put in place mechanisms for the old guard to defend itself and fight against reform. And here's the question it really poses. How much confidence do you have in Murray to select a good new police chief if this is who he puts in as the interim police chief?
Well, and who Ed Murray has said is the role model for the person he would like to hire. He was very specific about that.
So Murray, in his statement, and this is again from Steve Miletich's Times article, he's quoting Ed Murray in his statement, technically a day of training is considered a lesser punishment than a day off, but Chief Bailey felt that mandating a training and education day for the officer in question would be a more constructive use of time and a better way of addressing the issue, not just to penalize behavior, but to shape the kind of behavior we want to see from our police force.
Well, you could
sounds
also
good.
You,
the,
no,
it
I,
I said I almost fell for that, because that isn't a bad, instead of go home and sit in your jammies, wouldn't it be better to be in training? Yes, but what about the discipline declaration on the file for that person?
Right.
Can't you do both?
And with
but
the,
that goes away under this system.
And with the unpaid day off, you're losing pay. So there's a pocketbook penalty also. And take out the word technically in that statement then from Ed Murray. Just, do a little edit there. And what you have is an admission. We are giving this guy a lesser punishment. Why? because we want to give him training instead. Well, this is a false choice. You can punish the person and give them training.
You know, among the people I'd like to hear from, and I hope we do in the next week, is the monitor and the monitor staff, because they are in charge of now what's happening with the police department, not just once a new police chief is chosen. Everybody wants to get a new police chief chosen and the consent decree ended more quickly. But I'm curious how the monitor views these actions. So maybe we'll ask. All right, we'll take a break. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW with Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. I'm Steve Scher. You are tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, The Week in Review. Every Friday at 10 o'clock, we talk about the news of the week from this Puget Sound, and we also look a little bit further with Knut Berger, who writes at Crosscut.com, Joni Balter, who's a news analyst and host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and Eli Sanders, who's associate editor at The Stranger. You know, if you miss part of the show, you can podcast it through the magic of podcasting. We live in time and space. So you can search for A Week in Review on iTunes or at KUW's own home page. Well, all right, so there was one aspect of something to kick around that we saw what happened with Ed Murray and the police department. The other thing that's happening is this broader question of how is the minimum wage going to change, and the minimum wage being proposed here and a lower minimum federal wage being proposed for an increase around the country. I want to just play you two cuts. There were fast food workers who led a boycott at the city's hamburger joints yesterday, calling for a 15-hour minimum wage. This is Crystal Thompson. She works at Domino's Pizza.
Never know how many hours I'm going to have. I could have 20 hours one week and 40 the next, so it's tough.
She also has an autistic son, and this is so she's dealing with those issues. Here's Bill Kitchen. He was driving by the protest, and he stopped to talk to Joshua McNichols, who was getting taped for KUOW.
What do you think that the rent's going to be across Seattle? It's going to go up. What do you think they're going to do if they can't make a profit here? They're going to close it. What do you think's going to happen to the people that work here? They're not going to be making $15 an hour. They're going to be making nothing.
So this is a conundrum. And the Congressional Budget Office came out with a report and, you know, it looked at the pros and cons of this.
And there are pros and cons, of course. You know, the Congressional Budget Office came out with a report that said that if the federal minimum wage is raised to $10.10 an hour, that up to or about 500,000 people could lose their jobs by the second half of 2016. But on the other hand, they said that all these folks would have, millions of people would have obviously higher wages, and that nearly a million people would be lifted out of poverty.
A million families, wasn't it?
Well, it depends on if you count the individual as part of the family. So however you want to count that is fine. But nearly 900,000 Americans would be lifted out of poverty, plus their families, yes. And so that, you know, that's like you have to weigh those, how you feel about that. One difference between what's going on here in Seattle and nationally, there's no way the United States House is going to go along with the 10-10 federal minimum wage. But our city council is definitely, as far as I'm concerned, going to go to $15 in some fashion. It could be phased in. It could exclude some small businesses. But there are like, what, zero votes against this idea? I think that's the right number.
There's something on the 500,000 jobs lost number. There's actually an important distinction here. That's not 500,000 people who are going to be fired. That is 500,000 jobs. It's more correctly described as 500,000 jobs disappearing. In other words, employers would, you know, meld people's hours together, cut back on the number of people that they're hiring. And these would be the really super temporary low-wage jobs. So they're kind of the jobs that Nick Hanauer was referring to in the really good Seattle Times profile of him this weekend. He's a very wealthy individual, basically that cast as a one percenter for the minimum wage in this profile, which he is. And he was saying, you know, yeah, some jobs will go away. They're probably the jobs that should go away. And some businesses will go out of business. If your business can't survive by paying people a living wage, then maybe your business should go out of business. That's what we're looking at when we're talking about the 500,000 jobs that would disappear. And the question is whether people having more money to spend will help create more jobs for them, for these the jobs that are disappearing, to replace those jobs, I guess.
Well, one of the interesting things you're seeing emerging, Hanauer touches on this. There are other people, the fellow whose name escapes me, but in California, that are conservatives making the case for the for a higher minimum wage, and basically pointing out that we're already paying billions of dollars in subsidies via welfare to companies like Walmart that essentially hire people at unlivable wages and then teach them how to go on welfare. So,
or have food drives for them during
or
the holidays.
Or have food drives, or you know, get them on food stamps and that kind of thing. And so essentially, you know, you have a situation where the private sector has offloaded a lot of the cost of these employees onto the public sector. And if you wanted to reduce federal welfare spending, you have to have the money has to come from somewhere. And it has to, you know, part of the problem is because of the income disparities, it's going to have to come out of the pockets of the corporations that are benefiting from these kinds of welfare tactics. And I think that's really interesting to see the way that argument is kind of coalescing and emerging on the right.
There's an interesting thing happening in the business world. Didn't Gap yesterday say they were going to raise their minimum wage of their employees, and something even like Walmart was considering it? I want to go back to the 500,000 lost jobs. The White House, about 20 seconds after this, the CBO report came out, was ready with this paper that pushed back on this number in a different way. And it was talking about how they're at, I mean, yes, this is a serious problem on the other side of the White House position, but also that the CBO folks conceded it could also be not as many as 500,000, that was just a number that in practice it could be less.
Some of the conservatives who are making the argument that Knut was describing also put forward an idea that's called a minimum income, essentially that you would do away with a lot of welfare programs, or maybe all of welfare as we understand it, and everyone in the United States would make a minimum income, be guaranteed a minimum income. And this would actually be cheaper than a lot of our spending on social services, on giving people money who don't have jobs or the ability to work. It wouldn't be a great income, but it would be a minimal income that you could get by on.
That sounds European socialism.
Well, I was going to say, and you know what Republican first suggested that?
Richard Nixon,
that communist.
Yeah, but I want to go back to one thing too. Yeah, Richard Nixon. There was a couple of weeks ago, I thought a pretty interesting column by Judith Gilley. I've talked about this before, who runs City People's Mercantile. And she says two things, and I'm going to say the lower thing first. Her argument is big retailers like Pottery Barn, Fred Meyer, Target, and Home Depot would figure out ways to raise prices or simply invest in more self-serve check stands in order to pay a higher wage. But your favorite neighborhood retail store where an actual cashier or owner knows you by name might soon be a thing of the past. Now, that's happening whether minimum wage is going up or not. But aren't we just propelling this corporatization of all our main streets?
Well, the internet is already challenging, that's what you're saying, is already challenging businesses like that. But somebody did some research, I'll probably blow this, but let me try it. You know, that if Walmart, with its low prices, began to pay a higher minimum wage, that it would have to raise its prices something like 1.5%. Do you know how minor that is? That is not.
Well, I know, like, I get some big savings at Walmart, you know.
I understand, but that is not, you know, that doesn't really shake the universe as much as it might sound. But that is a different. But her
argument is that
her argument is different for small business, and that's why that some of them may be exempted. You know, when Ed Murray talks about this, he talks about, you know, bringing business along on this, and then you have Councilmember Shauna Sawant saying she wants a purer. However you say that, a $15 minimum wage.
Is that like what Boehner talks about when he talks about a clean bill?
No.
No, it's different.
Almost.
It's different.
I don't know if it's the opposite, but it's very different. But this is a debate shaping up on the council and between the council and the mayor right now, whether you go the Shauna Sawant route, which is full $15 minimum wage as soon as possible, or what some small business owners are pushing for and what Ed Murray sometimes seems to be in favor of, which is a phased-in route to the $15 an hour over many years and maybe some exemptions along the way.
But he doesn't want a number lower than 15. He told me that.
Ever?
Ever? I mean, you
After this work happens, he wants it to be $15 or more.
Yeah. After the phase-in.
After the phase-in. Yeah. Whatever
it is.
Yeah.
So it might take a number of years to get there, and you know, who knows what the cost of living would be then.
Well, and there are other pieces of the puzzle. It's not just a wage issue. For example, for business owners, small business owners, if you could combine moving on the one hand on the minimum wage, but on the other hand, moving on tax reform,
right,
so that you could give businesses relief from an onerous B&O and reduce subsidies or find a way to get more progressive taxation in this state, you would have a situation where those small business people, the Main Street business people, the non-corporate people, would not be overburdened on the tax side while paying a fair wage. And I think most employers, even small employers, want to pay people well.
Well, that was the other point that Judith Gilley was making in her column. I believe it's time big corporations like Boeing and Amazon and .com and wealthy individuals in this state shoulder a larger percentage of the taxes currently borne by small businesses and low to middle income people.
And you see an argument for that in the mayor's State of the City speech, although he didn't make this argument. He should have. He said when he was talking about the minimum wage to highlight the income inequality that we have in Seattle that the top 20% of earners in Seattle brought in more than the bottom 80% combined since, I believe it was 2000. So that's over a 14-year period, if I'm remembering the date right. But for a very long time, 20% of high-income earners in Seattle have been making more than the bottom 80% combined. Well, you don't resolve a problem like that just by raising the minimum wage. You have to do something on the tax side, on the revenue side. So why isn't the mayor of Seattle proposing an income tax for Seattle? That would really help with this problem that he's describing, but you don't hear it from him.
Wow. How do you even propose an income tax just for a city when all these people are making their money commuting in and out?
It would be based on where you live. Been able to measure the income.
This is good
of people
for Medina real estate, isn't it?
Or Shoreline.
Well, I'm sure you would hear arguments like
that. Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of benefits to living in Seattle, and I don't think, you know, you hear the same thing in Manhattan about their income tax. The rich have not fled Manhattan en masse because of the income tax that exists there.
There's so much snow on the ground they can't get out.
How long have, I don't know if you know this, and I should look it up before I ask, but how long has New York had an income tax that's just focused on people who live in New York City as opposed to the larger state?
I don't know the answer to that, right. But it's worth remembering while we're talking about this that Washington State is one of a very few states that doesn't have any income tax at all and consistently is ranked as the most regressive state when it comes to taxation because we rely only on the sales tax, which penalizes poor people more than rich people.
All right. So I'm going to use this to transition because this is all in a sense, these are part of the same questions. Jerry Large, I apparently was reading the Seattle Times a lot today, this week. Jerry Large quoted an author, and it was about the decline of unions. And this was the quote, "A shrinking labor movement would increase inequality. That happened." And Rosenfeld, the author, writes that the decline also made it harder for immigrants to climb into the middle class, worsened racial inequality, left working class Americans without a powerful political voice. So that is our starting point. What do you make of what happened we'll start with the UAW in Volkswagen in Tennessee. They defeated the call for a union. The workers there voted down a union. Volkswagen said, you know, we're agnostic on this because in Germany we bring our workers in through workers' councils and they have unions and we work together to come up with good ideas to make the plant make the work better and the company healthy. The argument against the UAW has been, well, the UAW didn't do that in Detroit. They just cared about their workers, didn't take the long view. And that's why these workers then
but
voted
that's
down.
What happened there is that there were several politicians who stood up and said, do you want this to turn into Detroit? Look what the UAW did for Detroit.
Yeah, they did a full court press on that.
Full court, and then talked about also some benefits that could come if they didn't go for the union, that the plant could be bigger and do more things and hire more people. So there really was a concerted effort, not by Volkswagen, but by the political establishment in that area. That's what happened.
Predominantly Republican, we should say. And so they made the case that the company didn't either want to make or just didn't make, that in another state you would have probably seen the company making along with politicians perhaps.
But it was interesting that the company didn't do that. The company decided to stay. And they have also said they may still look at the notion of worker councils at those factories.
Which, you know, culture, that's the culture in Germany. And so they were not afraid of that.
Right. I was just going to say that. It's really interesting and refreshing in a way to see a company that is not scared of working with its workers, that doesn't have an us or them mentality, but a way to have a collaborative relationship and would like it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And then we could I'll circle back around, but to the bigger question of immigrants and stuff. But then Boeing and their decision to build the 777X wing here.
Yeah, that was interesting because you heard that the machinist did not show up at the kind of victory ceremony for that thing. They were pointedly staying away. Boeing has indicated, you know, now they're looking to the machinists here to kind of save their tails, as it were, or their wings.
Save their wings.
and it's exactly the argument, of course, that the machinists were putting forward, which is they're going to need us. We don't want to make concessions because we know that they ultimately can't do without us. And the company is now wanting to, bury the hatchet, play nice, do all this. They're saying, hey, we've made essentially a 50-year commitment.
Right.
You know, so they're kind of back to playing up their roots and trying to mend the fences. But politically, I think those fences will take a while to mend if they're indeed truly mendable.
Yeah. They're in full PR mode because they know that they've left a very sour taste.
Boeing is.
They know they've left a very sour taste here. A couple of politicians, Representative Rick Larson and even the governor, have been, you know, at odds now with the machinists because of how this came down. They have work to do on that front.
Well,
they
problems that came up this week were being discussed about the 787 in South Carolina. And the problems there. And, of course, one of the arguments has been that they've been relying on a workforce that doesn't have the experience and training and commitment that this one does. So, they're under the microscope.
I'm going to we'll take a break. And then when we come back, I just want to follow up on that a little bit, that notion of where the unions sit in this debate over wages and inequality. You're listening to The Week in Review. This is KUOW, Week in Review. I'm Steve Scherr. Knut Berger is here. Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. We're talking about the news of this week. I want to come back to that question we left before the break, that question of where the unions stand and where they could stand in this debate over the minimum wage, which is really a debate over inequality, which is really a discussion about the widening gap between rich and poor. President Obama has made this case. And the unions have been, in some ways, I don't want to say a sideshow, because I know many people disagree with that, but in some ways, in terms of the conversation, they've not been incorporated into that conversation. And this is the contrast between what happened at the UAW, which is Tennessee politicians making one statement, but the company making another. And what happened with Boeing and the realization of their need, and this debate over who and how are we going to pay for it? Are we seeing, I think I've asked this about every few weeks, are we seeing a shift in what unions could offer people?
Well, let's look at the numbers. So it used to be that more than a third of workers were members of unions. Now is that number down to 20, I thought I read?
20%.
So that's quite a decline there. And when you talk about income inequality, you know, the Congressional Budget Office report sort of makes you talk about different groups. Are you talking about people who might lose their jobs? Are you talking about people who are working and living off the minimum wage who are in poverty? And in this case, are you talking about people sort of trying to move into the middle class as they are represented by unions with better paying jobs?
Yeah. We've seen unions really pushing for the minimum wage here in Seattle, so I'm not sure if the argument that they have nothing to offer really is borne out here. I think they were pretty instrumental in getting the minimum wage passed in SeaTac. They were
part of it. I don't mean they have nothing to offer. I mean, are they now, like you're saying with SeaTac, are they in the middle of the discussion in a way where they can't be marginalized?
Well, what they're finding is that they have more success at the moment getting their members out to help push reform at the ballot box and by pressuring elected officials than they are having at the negotiating table with corporations, where, you know, to throw another number out there, when during the whole Boeing standoff, there were the numbers that kept coming out about how few Americans now have defined pensions, including now the Boeing workers, which is another sign of declining clout for unions.
You know, to me, it seems like the thing that unions have in recent years exemplified, that conversation has now become mainstream to people who aren't in unions, which is living wage, what are your retirement benefits, the loyalty to place, to community. You know, these have been important union issues, and a lot of labor reforms unions have a role in, but they take place outside the unions. The 8-hour workday, the child labor laws, minimum wage. I mean, these are things that that unions help the rest of us who aren't in unions get some advantage from. So I don't think unions are the solution for everybody, but I think they have kind of a golden moment right now. People are talking about income inequality. That is, and the thing is, you know, can you find a way to sort of make a deal? I mean, the classic deal in Seattle that was struck was by Dave Beck, head of the Teamsters Union. And you talk about a deal that was made there, which is essentially said, if you deal with us, we will root out the far left elements in the labor movement, but you have to bring us into the middle class in exchange. So they made a flat out political deal. And these things are often chaotic and complicated and involve those kinds of big picture adjustments over time.
Well, I've been thinking about the idea that if you think about a year or two ago, all anybody could talk about was how to get any jobs. So the conversation has definitely progressed to what kind of job and what does it pay. And, you know, so the minimum wage is part of that, clearly.
Well, and the argument that Nick Hanauer and others have made is, and also the conservative California commentator, is that these are the jobs that are minimum wage and below. The people are trying to see raised to minimum wage or even higher are jobs that won't go away in the way the manufacturing jobs went away, theoretically. But that also asks then all the Americans who are getting their dollar burgers to pay $1.50 for their burger, or $2.
Maybe not that much because of the Walmart example. It isn't that big of a price increase. There's probably a little price increase there, but I don't think there's a big one.
Yeah, I'm rounding up. So they get a decent wage. By the way, in 2013, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, union membership rate, percentage of wage and salary workers who were members of unions, 11.3%. In 1983, the first year when they started looking at it, union membership was 20%. And at that time, there were 17 million union workers. Now there are about 14 million.
Well, there you go.
So there's the shift. And the change. All right. Well, it's an interesting question because and you put it well, Skip, because they are looking at these questions in a broad context now. We got a few emails, by the way. Question for the panel. Did the Tennessee lawmakers who opposed the VW workers unionizing break any federal law? If so, could the Justice Department take action? I believe other people have raised that question and that is being looked at. And Maggie, when we talked about paying the minimum wage, and this goes to your point, I believe that our $15 minimum wage is the equivalent of previous year's minimum wage. If small businesses survived then, it should survive now. And on the question of the police, this is a story I don't know very well, but this is what Martin is saying. What about the officer whose son shot his sister with dad's revolver? Hung jury, no punishment, job reinstated. What happened to Janisha McIntosh, whose son shot himself the same week? She pled guilty to manslaughter. Just the wheels of justice or preferential treatment for authority figures? And Walter arguing, I find it amazing that you and your colleagues seem surprised that there is a police payback. Isn't this an ongoing problem with the police? Hasn't it been this way for a very long time? Just always hopeful, Walter. We're just always hopeful. That's all.
Well, one thing that the stranger was concerned about when we endorsed McGinn over Ed Murray was Murray's courting of the Police Guild endorsement. I mean, so in that sense...
And McGinn didn't want the endorsement?
Well, McGinn didn't get it, so maybe he didn't promise the right thing. And maybe we wouldn't have had Chief Bailey under a second McGinn administration. So there were people who were concerned about this before the election.
Yeah. All right, I'm shifting to pot. Since we seem to be getting ever closer to becoming the second pot state. And I have these questions for you, Knut, Eli, and Joni, and Luke Burbank. Luke, I'm bringing you in early because I know when we talk about pot, you're right there, right?
Well, I would like to circle back to a previous conversation. We're talking about income inequality and what a living wage is, and I continue to do these appearances gratis.
I knew he was going to do that.
I'm not mentioning that you're host of LiveWire on KUOW tonight at 8 then.
It is going to be a humdinger of a show tonight. I can't lie to you. But all right, fine. Moving on. You were saying about pot?
That's some hardball negotiating.
Yeah, right on the air.
Or am I mentioning that he's the host of a podcast called TBTL, Too Beautiful to Live?
Yeah.
There are other ways to work this, Luke.
Yeah, maybe we can form a work council?
There you go.
You guys can take it there.
There you go. You guys are the work council. Am I the manager in this
apparently
situation? Excellent. Washington cut the size of grows and the number of legal pot grows as well because they got so many applications. People were very excited to be into this business. Were you surprised that their decision was, well, we're not going to give quite as much space to everybody and maybe we're not going to increase the number of licenses?
Well, you have a liquor control board, and what they do is control. What they're there for. I mean, if people thought this was going to be a completely free market situation, they were mistaken because they're trying to essentially nurture and create a market where you've got all these entrepreneurs raising money, wanting to build these large grows, and the state wanting to control it to the extent that the market is coherent.
Well, it's not just the Liquor Control Board that's doing this just to be control freaks. You know,
36 million square feet was under the application.
Right.
They wanted 2 million.
Well, not to get too far into the weeds, bad pun. What they have to do with the Department of Justice is not produce so much pot here that it diverts across state lines. I know it sounds wonky and weird, but that actually is what's driving this. And so they were absolutely overwhelmed by the number of applications. They didn't expect 7,000 and just unlimited pot growing. So now they've had to reduce it to one license to a customer, so to speak, and less acreage, less square footage, I guess. Per license, so that they can manage this, because they only expect to have something like 25% of the market at the beginning, in the early months. And so it has to be, you can't just flood the market with pot and then have it go across state lines, because the Department of Justice will call us and not say nice things.
But for people who are going big with their business plans, this becomes a hardship. There's the example of the people who are planning to buy the old K2 ski factory on Vashon Island, which is a site that really works with all the zoning laws about where this can and can't be, plus Vashon Island.
I get it.
That's redundant.
They are not now able to grow as much weed as the factory could hold, which makes their business plan not pencil out, which means maybe they won't do it at all.
They also are letting banks do some business. I know that the president and CEO of the Colorado Bankers Association said the decision by the federal government about letting banks do pot work is, what did he call it? After a series of red lights, we expected this guidance to be a yellow one. This isn't close to that. At best, this amounts to serve those customers at your own risk. Luke, where are you getting your money for your pot business?
The illegal dispensary I'm running out of my basement. You know, I will say, though, Joni, I know you and I live roughly in the same neighborhood. The life cycle of every retail business starts out as something and then eventually turns into either medical marijuana or CrossFit.
There you go. No, I know which one you mean.
Or maybe spa. That is really the eventual fate of every single business. I was going to say, though, I really think that the thing that I think that the state should be worried about if they're trying to curtail illegal selling and illegal use of pot is if there are too many hoops to jump through, if the cost ends up being too high because of all of the taxes and regulations, all of the people in Seattle who have been smoking a lot of Dubage for a long time will just continue to get it from wherever they're getting it from, don't you think?
That is the delicate balancing act here. They want to make it a good thing to walk into a Washington State pot store. You know that the pot has been tested. You know, seriously, like, you know what? Do you know what some of the pot that you're referring to has in it? It has some scary stuff like mildew, spider, something or other, bugs of some sort. I mean, there's a lot of weird
bugs
stuff in there, and pesticides that you probably do not want to know the name of them. So you have to be careful. So they're trying to compete with like this clean, pure pot, but it also they're going to tax it quite a bit too. So the price, you know, it cuts along price points.
There's also a concern in the way the state's doing the licensing about the carbon footprint of a lot of these amateur grow-ups that, you know, the state was trying to kind of be fair and give a grow-up to almost as to everyone. And there are a lot of people who don't know how to do it economically or environmentally, I guess.
I've been tapping into my neighbor's power supply.
Well, that works.
That shows up on the grid. They can measure that. That shows
up. Yeah, I know. I got about 3 weeks left of this thing before all hell breaks loose.
By the way, have you also been tapping into your neighbor's cable because you don't like paying that Comcast monopoly? How's that for that was a good segue there.
That was one of them.
Yeah.
I have to how do I do this delicately? I have to recuse myself because I used to do ads on the radio station for Comcast, and they gave me free cable, and I stopped doing them long ago, but they haven't figured out that they're still giving me free cable, so I'm really okay with whatever it is Comcast is doing.
That was pretty smart. I don't think you should have mentioned that.
Probably. I am bought off so
it's
easily.
Almost like the other thing you mentioned. It was
free. You were saying that Jack Schaefer had an argument for why the merger, the Comcast, a lot of people are raising questions, including Ed Murray, about this plan for Comcast and Time Warner to merge. We have Comcast in our neck of the woods, and some people don't think we get very good service, but Jack Schaefer was making an argument for it.
Well, he had a really interesting column, and Jack Schaefer's the media columnist for Reuters, formerly with Slate, former Seattleite. And he had an interesting article which basically said, you know, Comcast's model is dying. That essentially the model that we should be promoting more of and that is ascendant are alternative ways of getting television through the phone company or Google or other.
Well, Netflix is what I've seen mentioned. Right.
There are other competitors coming in, including ones providing broadcasts. They're phone companies that are providing essentially cable service. So he was basically saying they're paying. What did he say? It's a $45 billion deal. They're paying $4,000 per customer to get this monopoly. And he was essentially saying they're spending themselves into oblivion, that this is a situation where they're trying to shore up something that the foundations are washing out underneath, and that you know, we should be pursuing policies that allow those sort of 1,000 businesses to bloom and let Comcast fall under its own weight.
A lot of references to communism this week. All right. Knut also wrote an article. Seattle needs a new nickname. Emerald City, Jet City, Queen City. What's our next catchy moniker? You have one, Luke?
Dog City. That's where I live. We have a puppy, and I'm staring at it right now, and it's all I can really see. I don't know if that'll get popular, but it would work for me.
Dog City's not bad. I was downtown, and there's this whole new building that has a downtown doggy daycare, and you can stand at the window and look at all the dogs.
Don't
playing.
Forget, if you work at Amazon, you can take, and I don't know the final number, 1, 2, or 3 dogs to work every day. And if the dogs don't get along, and I'm just sort of winging it here, maybe they have somebody on staff who can help them facilitate, you know, a better dog relationship at work.
There's actually a button you hit on your Kindle Fire, and a person comes up and tells your dog how to stop being such a jerk.
What's your choice for?
Well, I don't have one, but my Facebook friends and had a huge discussion about this, and some of the ones that I thought were great were the Wet Spot,
that's good,
the Big Dripper, 12 City, Mossy Town. We should sell the naming rights.
Oh, that's good.
Bertha's Bane, Microzon, Processopolis, Seattle Hagen. The one that I liked was. The city that could eventually do everything once there was enough inclusion and review of all options.
There you go. That'll roll right off the tongue. You know, you got to leave that Bertha out of here. We're just picking on that former mayor so much. But you know what I saw this week? It said that in D.C. they have this sewage system underground that's named Lady Bird. Just saying.
Just saying. All right, Luke Burbank hosts LiveWire tonight at 8.
Hey, and by the way, tonight we have the Von Trapps on the show, the grandkids of the actual Von Trapps who climbed every mountain.
Did you sing Sound of Music songs with them on the air?
I sort of talked them into closing with Edelweiss, which was actually more affecting and kind of fun than you might imagine.
I want to see Luke in Lederhosen.
I do,
the
too.
The weird part was we tried to get them out on stage like 8 different times, and we kept announcing them, and then it was just...
They wouldn't come back.
They wouldn't come out. They were trying to escape LiveWire, but we wrangled them back.
And that's what you'll hear tonight. All right, Luke, thank you.
Thank you.
Luke, Knute Berger, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Eli Joni, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Week in Review is produced by Jason Pagano and Kane. Guy Nelson's engineering today. I'm Steve Scherer.